Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 391. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have an incredible show for you this week with two incredible guests. Let me introduce the first one to you right this very second. Karen Mason is an acclaimed, award-winning Broadway star and concert artist. She originated the role of Tanya on Broadway in ABBA's Mamma Mia and was awarded a 2002 Drama Desk nomination as Best Actress for that work. Her other leading roles include Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard, which she performed to critical acclaim and standing ovations on Broadway and in Los Angeles for years, Velma von Tussle in the final Broadway company of Hairspray, Rosalie in Carnival, and featured roles in Broadway's Torch Song trilogy and Play Me a Country Song. She won the Outer Critics Circle Award for her performance in one of my absolute favorite shows, And the World Goes Round, and she starred off-Broadway in her own show, Karen Mason Sings Broadway, Beatles, and Brian. Karen most recently garnered rave reviews starring as the Queen of Hearts in Wonderland on Broadway. If I list her many awards, we won't have time to actually chat, but let me just say that Karen is a 12-time MAC Award winner. That would be the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs, most recently Show of the Year and Celebrity Artist in 2016. She has also won the 2006 Nightlife Award for Major Female Vocalist and has 3 Bistro Awards. On March 3rd, Karen will be releasing a new album entitled It's About Time with some very special tracks that we are going to talk all about. But first, Karen Mason, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Wow, I'm already exhausted just listening to that. Thank you so much, Ken. This is 391. Episode 391 has got to have a lot of good luck involved with it.
I think. It continues with you. Let me just say, on behalf of everybody else out there, it's enough already with the MAC Awards. Other people would like to win some, Karen.
Hey, a lot of people have won them aside from myself, but I feel very lucky and honored to have won so many. It's nice to be rewarded by your peers. Wow. It really is. I'm lucky I get a chance to go and sing songs that I like. It's and work with people that I love. It's a good deal.
Well, we have so much ground to cover, Karen. Are you ready?
I am.
Let's go back to little Karen Mason. What I'm learning about you, there was a high school production of Carousel, and it all started there.
Actually, that was my second high school production. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, Sacred Heart of Mary, and the boys' school, girls' schools and boys' schools, they always have brother and sister schools. So the boys' school did the musicals. The nuns did not do musicals at our school, so I had to go elsewhere. And St. Viator did the musicals. And the first one that I did, it was the very first year that they had them, from what I understand, was Annie, Get Your Gun. And yes. I had a line. I was part of the townspeople. And it just certainly got me hooked. So the next year I went back and got to play Carrie Pipperidge in Carousel. And actually the reason I did it, aside from loving to sing, was because I wanted a date for prom.
There it is.
And, yeah, there you go. Practical girl. And so I went and didn't meet anybody to go to prom with, but I found a career choice.
I love it. Is it true, by the way, I read this online, that production of Carousel is when your parents first figured out that you were really good at this? Had they no idea before that?
It's not that they didn't know that I, had a proclivity toward this. We always did shows for my parents when I was growing up. And, I always was opening up my big mouth to sing and to, to be loud. And I was a middle child, so I had to do something to stick out. But I think this was this was the beginning of their really knowing that this was something special for me.
I love that.
And that it really meant a lot to me. And then when I went to college, you know, my parents were of a generation, and I assume this is just a parental thing too, that gets something to fall back on. And to me, that just said they really don't believe in what I want to do. So there was a lot of fighting during college, and I started doing some community theater, and that led to my older sister giving me a note about this restaurant that
yes.
she had been to downtown Chicago called Lawrence of Oregano's. And she said, they're having singing, you know, auditions for singing waiters and waitresses. You have to go. Because I was doing all of this, not particularly happy. My parents, because I was still doing community theater, I wanted to be close to the people who were doing it and getting paid for it. And I just didn't have the guts. You know, it's funny. I had a big voice and loved being on stage, always felt like it was home, but just was a bit of a coward, I guess, when it came to putting myself in the middle of the fire. And at Lawrence of Oregano's, I met Brian Lasser, who was my music director for 16 years. And he was definitely fearless about jumping into the fire. So between the two of us, you know, I just attached myself to his wagon. And I think when my parents saw me with Brian, I think they knew that there was no going back.
Yeah. I can't get past the name Lawrence of Oregano's. I just can't. I can't get past it. Now, was this one of those places where you would stop doing your work and you would go sing? As in, like,
yeah,
when while
absolutely.
You were waiting tables? Or were you singing as you were waiting tables?
No. You would stop.
You
they
would
had
stop.
Little shows.
Okay.
And there were, I think, 27 singers, 27 people who were working in the restaurant who worked with Brian. And he did arrangements for everybody and oversaw these little shows. They had a little stage at the end of the restaurant. And so you'd get up and you know, go do these little sets or little shows, and everybody would have a number, and there'd be an opener and a closer. It was a fantastic restaurant. It was a Let Us Entertain You restaurant. You know, a nice theme, but it was so much fun, and people loved it.
Yeah.
And I put on about 30 pounds because I ate all of the pasta salad that I could dole out. They wouldn't let me be a waitress. I didn't have any experience, and so they let me be a hostess, and I wasn't particularly good at that, so I just basically was a singer with pasta salad.
I love it. That is a resume builder that I would love to have. I will tell you, I was a singing waiter for a month in New York City. I was not very good at it. So I love hearing that you were very successful at this. It makes me very happy.
Well, I was successful at handing out pasta salad. I couldn't do the waiting part. It was not in my skill set.
Well, tell our listening audience about that partnership with Brian Lasser.
Oh, Brian Lasser changed my life. It was just one of those relationships that the second you meet that person, you know that it's meant to be,
yeah.
that you have to have this person in your life. And Brian was the music director and a year younger than me, but he was a showman. He was an actor and a dancer and a singer and a composer, writer, you know, arranger. He did everything and had this life in him that just, I knew I had to be close to him. And so we started, the second I auditioned with him, I think he said that he knew the same thing. He felt like he had found his Judy Garland.
Oh, wow.
And, listen, every singer wants to hear that, right?
Yeah.
That somebody that they love and admire believes in them. So we started doing, Brian got fired from Lawrence of Oregano's. Not totally fired. They were planning on just, Brian's aspirations were to increase the visibility and add bass and drums, and they wanted to cut back on how much it was costing them. So Brian left, and I thought, I'm not sticking around here. I'm done with the pasta salad if Brian Lasser's not part of the program. So I left with him, and we started doing private parties and then cabarets, and then we decided to move to New York. It was a relationship that I was a fat kid, and fat middle children, it's a harder row to hoe.
Right.
You know, because there's so much competition then, right off the bat. And here was somebody who totally just believed in me. And I was overwhelmed by it. So we started working together, and we worked together for 16 years. And we were each other's muse.
Yeah.
He was my mentor and my friend and helped me develop whatever, you know, Karen Mason style is, or whatever acting chops I have, or singing chops. You know, he really helped me to figure that out. And what a gift. What a gift. And was willing to do it for just half of whatever I was paid.
Unbelievable.
That is unheard of. It was a kind of a very innocent, naive time. And you know, also cabarets were allowing people to work 5-6 nights a week. So you could do a long period of time. You could do a run and learn. I mean, there were many nights that we just sucked. And still, they would let us come back the next night.
That's New York. It's amazing. It's amazing. I was reading all about Brian this morning, and it, you know, you just read about someone, and every now and then you read about someone and you think, oh my gosh, this is a guy I wish I had been able to meet. Just sounds like an incredible artist and an incredible human. So just,
he was.
Yeah.
He was so generous as an artist, especially as a writer. There was no arrogance with his writing. He wrote with a generosity of spirit that is very hard to find.
Yeah.
He was protective of his work, but not arrogant about it.
Amazing.
And as a result, he came up with some of, I think, for me, to my heart, some of the most beautiful songs that, you know, people hear them and become attached to them. You know, they speak to their hearts. And that's a rare songwriting quality, I think.
It is. It is. Well, before we talk about the new album, we have to talk about one of your iconic roles. In an interview years ago, you said this about your work in Sunset Boulevard. You said, quote, toward the beginning, it was just jumping off the cliff. But toward the end, I was finding my own Norma. Tell our listening audience about how you go about interpreting such an iconic role like this.
It was quite a journey.
Yeah.
Because I was covering not just a role, but I was covering Norma Desmond and covering Glenn Close. So there was a lot of pressure. And when you do a Broadway show, or, you know, a show that is soon to be in Broadway, a Broadway-sized show like Sunset Boulevard, I didn't realize, because I had never covered anyone before, covered a role before, that you are not their top priority. You are not even perhaps their bottom priority. It's kind of up to you. So I just kept wondering, you know, as I'm sitting there watching the rehearsals and feeling, you know, increasingly on the outside, that when are we going to run through the music? When am I going to get a chance to do this, to run the blocking? And you don't. You basically have to grab it yourself. I mean, if people understood what swings, covers, standbys go through, I think there would be a deeper appreciation of the talent, the skill that goes with it. And so I basically had to beg, borrow, and steal time from these very busy people working on the show, the music directors, the dance captains, to help me with it. I hired a friend of mine, Justin Ross, who's a director, actor, playwright, and he was living out in Los Angeles at the time, and he would come over twice a week and work with me on the script so that I could really try to find my own Norma. I'm a rehearsal girl. I don't find things in a vacuum necessarily, you know, sitting at home running lines. I need to have an interconnection with another actor, and that's how I discover things. So it was a strange situation. So the first time I went on, I felt relatively armed, but it was still jumping off a cliff.
Yeah.
Because you don't get the previews. You basically, you know, run the lines with people in hallways because you're going to be going. The first time I went on, I had 2 days. And this was, you know, the show had been running for a while.
Yeah.
She is a very responsible actor. You know, she's got an incredible ethics about her performing. And she did not miss. So this was kind of into the performance schedule of Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. And I got a 2-day notice. So that's when we got to run the costume changes. That's when I got to have them on for periods of time. It basically ran up and down stairs, the stairs at the theater in my costumes. Not on the set, but up and down the stairs because I just needed to have them on. And, you know, would grab, and, you know, Alan Campbell or George Hearn, you know, whenever they would graciously give me 10 minutes to run a scene, you know, firing the gun. I never did that until half hour. And
wow.
Then the first time I went on, I got the feathers from the cape I was wearing as Norma caught in the gun.
Oh, God.
And it didn't fire. I mean, you know, there's all of this stuff that you go through, and it's like, oh, my God, this is a mess. And somehow you show up at the end of it, and no one has died, and you're fine, and the show has gone on, and you get a standing ovation. And how can that be? How can that be? So by the end of it, I had had enough time with these fine, generous actors and with Norma to be able to maybe not have all of the things that I wanted to know about her just be thoughts. They became a little bit more ingrained in my characterization. I think she became a little less Midwestern perky as time went on.
Incredible. Incredible work that you did on that. Again, listeners, we are here with Karen Mason, acclaimed, award-winning Broadway star, concert artist. We have to talk about this new album. Tell everybody about, and in particular, the title track, It's About Time.
Oh, Ken, I am so proud of this CD, and I'm proud of this title track, actually. The title track is It's About Time, and it was written as a gift to two friends of ours who were getting married. It was right after marriage equality passed in New York State. And our two friends, Perry and Peter, were getting married and asked if myself and Christine Petty, as a matter of fact, would entertain at their wedding. And we went out to dinner so that I could make sure that, you know, the set list had songs that they liked for their wedding. And as we were walking away, I said to my husband, Paul Rolnick, who's a songwriter, I said, this is a perfect opportunity for you to write a song. You have to write a song for them. And he did. He wrote this song. He had this hook going through his head. It's about love, it's about life, and it's about time. And I said, I loved it. He called Shelley Markham, who is one of his co-writers, and they wrote this amazing song that I was so proud of them. We sang it for Peter and Perry at their wedding. It was a big surprise to them. And it, to me, encapsulates what marriage equality and what any equality is about love. Marriage equality, to me, should be about love.
Yeah.
It's about nothing else but that. And it still is fascinating to me why people are hesitant to honor love in our culture. I think we're getting better, but then we go backwards a little bit, and hopefully we're still going forward. But to me, this is a song about, to people who maybe are afraid of change, which, to be honest with you, my husband is somebody who's afraid of change, not with marriage equality, but, right. you know, with change, he has to think through before he will do things like buy a new vacuum cleaner.
There it is.
Not that marriage equality and buying a new vacuum cleaner are equated, but I think you know what I mean.
Yes.
And so this, to me, is a perfect song that says, you know what, don't be afraid. It's about two people in love.
I have been playing it all morning. I love it. I absolutely love it. And by the way, not only that, you honor Judy Garland time and time again on this album.
Well, she was a huge influence on my life. And it's come back to me recently. In the past like 4 or 5 years, I've gotten a chance to do a couple of symphonic concerts of Judy Garland music and her original orchestrations. And I have to tell you, I am beyond happy when I'm doing that. To hear the bongos right before Come Rain or Come Shine,
yes.
you know, there's a big grin on my face, and it couldn't make me happier. So when Chris Denny, my music director, wanted to include The Man That Got Away and Over the Rainbow, it was fine. Let's find our way through it. Let's say it in a new way while still honoring the magic of Judy Garland. So I think we've tried to do that.
You know, some relationship experts, let me just tell you, Karen, some relationship experts have said don't work with your partner. You heard that and said, no, I'm going to make an album with my partner. Talk to me about working with your partner on a project like this.
Well, oh, it's fascinating. I have to say, listen, we're still together after 26 years. As a matter of fact, February 14th was our anniversary.
Oh, I
and
love that.
So I know we've been together 26 years and married 18, but it was a very long engagement. But working with my husband is difficult, and yet, you know, it's difficult because the expectations are higher for your partner than for somebody who's paying you. Your expectations are that this person's just going to know. And why are you being so hard on me?
Right.
And, you know, we both understand that. And we argue. You know, we're not afraid to bicker. And we do it quite loudly. I think we're both just learning that it's part of being a couple, is being unafraid to bicker with each other and contest each other. But down deep, there is an amazing amount of respect for what each other has to offer. And that supersedes any of the other, you know, baloney that happens, any of the other bullshit that happens along the way. It's just that we deeply respect and admire each other.
And look what comes of it. Look what comes of it. Well, as we have you on the show this week, I can't have you here without playing a little tiny game with you. And I think you're ready for this one. I could
I'm
not.
I'm so bad at games.
No,
but
I
okay.
don't. This one, I then great. This will be a confidence booster for you because I could not feel better for you. So as I said in your intro, one of my favorite musicals of all time is And the World Goes Around. And so I went online to find some And the World Goes Around trivia. And I have to tell you, not so much out there, and it's pretty easy. So I'm going to ask you four questions. If you get two of the four right, and by the way, I think you're going to get all four right. If you get two of the four right, you're going to win some This Show Is So Gay swag for a member of our listening audience. Are you ready to play? I could not be less worried.
You.
No.
You unknown person.
You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. In fact, right. I'm going to keep them open-ended, but if you need multiple choice, we can revert to that format as well. This is as
okay.
hard as the And the World Goes Round questions get on the internet. I could not be less worried for you. Question number one for Karen Mason. From what musical is the song And the World Goes Round originally from?
Isn't it from it's from a movie, isn't it?
It is.
It's from New York, New York.
It is indeed. Karen Mason, one correct. Question number two. I'm telling you, I'm not
okay.
worried. I'm not worried.
I'm ready to go now, Karen.
I knew we just needed one to grease the wheels. Now the rest are all downhill. Here we go. In the show 70 Girls 70, You could get your coffee in what?
I might need more time for this. A cardboard cup.
That is the correct answer. I know this is as hard. You know what, Karen? When you have free time, which I don't think you ever do, you need to write harder trivia questions for And the World Goes Round. Question number three.
I wonder why there's not more great trivia questions.
I don't know.
I don't know.
In fact, I had to write question number four. So here's question number three, though.
Okay.
In the show The Act, where could you see Arthur?
Where or when?
Right. So this said where, but I think the correct question is when.
In the afternoon.
That is correct. There we go. Where she's going to go.
You see him at his apartment in the afternoon.
I love it. And then I needed a Karen Mason specific question. This one's multiple choice. Which name is not one of the men of your past in Colored Lights? Which name is not one of the men of your past in Colored Lights? Is it Sam, Fred, Frank, or Pete?
Frank.
That is the correct answer. 4 for 4. I told you I could not have been less worried. I could not have been less worried. Well done. Well done.
Thank you. And I'm glad you like that show.
Oh, I love it.
Love that show.
I really and truly do, and it's such an ensemble piece, and it's I love it. Well,
they should bring it back because it really is. I mean, that music.
In my house here, it's back every day, so I don't know what you're talking about. It's playing every day. It's all the time. It's all the time. On March 6th, we have a release concert. Tell everybody about the release concert for It's About Time.
Yeah, I will be doing, this will be the release concert, like you said, at Birdland as part of the Broadway at Birdland series. Jim Caruso has put together this fantastic series of Broadway at Birdland. And so at 7 o'clock on March 6th, we'll be doing the CD release. It will be Ted Firth at the piano and Bob Renino, who's Sally Mae's husband, on bass, who played on the CD, and Rex Benincasa will be on drums. Both Rex and Bob played on the CD. And Chris Denny would have been at the piano, but he's going to be in Mexico working.
There it is.
So I asked Ted if he would do it, and I couldn't have found a greater guy to be working with. We'll be doing music from my CD, and also my husband, who wrote It's About Time, is releasing a CD of his music, so he'll be getting up and doing a couple things, and then we'll sing a duet together. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
And then his new song, Picking Out the Vacuum Cleaner, that's got to be coming up soon, right?
Oh, my God. You know, you have to be very careful what you say on the radio. Because he's going to, it's going to come back to him.
Oh, we have your back. We have your back. Listeners, this is what we need you to do. You need to stroll on over right this very second to KarenMason.com. You can learn all about Karen. You have to keep your eyes out, though, because on March 3rd, she will be releasing It's About Time. I had the wonderful opportunity to preview it. It's so stunning. I have been playing it nonstop. I will tell you this, Karen. I don't mean to boil your career down to one song because you've done such incredible work, but I have to tell you that your singing Colored Lights is such a huge part of my life, and for me actually embodies everything that I look for in performance. There's humor, you have character, incredible talent, and I'm so appreciative. This is one of those moments, I will tell you this, I've been doing this show for 8 years, and this is yet another reminder of the wonderful opportunity to do this show and get to talk to people who have really affected my life. And you truly have done that with your talent.
Oh, my God. Thank you, Ken. You know, that song was a lovely opportunity for me. You know, it did. I felt like, in a way, I made it my own. It certainly is Liza Minnelli's song. But I felt like I was able to really bring a little Karen Mason, Perky Midwesterner to it. And, you know, and I do love that singing that number. I just love it. It makes me very happy. So I'm happy that I was with you along the way.
You have been. And I will just tell you on a funny note, I recently, for the first time, played my partner. He had never heard The Grass Is Always Greener before. And I will say that I enjoy that song immensely. as did he. But there were a couple times when he said, oh, it's not over yet, is it? And I said, no, 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 there's many more minutes to go. So if someone needs a song that goes for a while and is very enjoyable, The Grass is Always Greener, Karen Mason, Brenda Presley, great stuff.
When we were doing that show, I remember it was Brenda and I kept saying, oh, my God. Because when you're in rehearsal and no one's laughing, it feels like torture because it's so slow. And we said, can't we pick it up? Come on. Can't we just pick it up a little? And Fred said, no, slower. I was like, oi, oi, oi. And then on opening night, you hear people laughing. And you go, huh-huh, he knows, he knows. Listen to Fred Ebb.
That's life lesson if ever there was one. Again, listeners,
that's right.
KarenMason.com. Karen, all the best with this new album. I'm so excited for you. And please keep using your talent in the incredible way that you have been using it.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Ken, so much. I hope you get a chance to come see the show.
I have had a sacred dream about us. You and I have waited for so long, walking down the aisle with each other, showing everyone where we belong. And isn't it amazing how it finally came to be? Standing at the altar for all the world to see. It's about a love that is meant to last forever. It's about a life that leaves nothing left behind. It's about all the time have left together. It's about love. It's about life.
All right, folks, and we are back with our second incredible guest for this week's jam-packed episode. Let me introduce him to you. Darren Calhoun is a photographer, a worship leader, a community activist, and so much more. He is worship leader at Urban Village Church there in Chicago, and he volunteers with organizations such as Breakthrough Urban Ministries, the Marin Foundation, where he contributed in the development of the I'm Sorry campaign at various different gay pride parades. Darren has also led groups on anti-racism, on racial reconciliation projects. He's done so much of that incredible work. I'm so excited to talk about it. He is also an associate fellow for racial justice at Evangelicals for Social Action. So much ground to cover. Darren, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Hey, hey. I'm glad to be here.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Let's start. I'm gonna start by labeling you. I don't know that I've ever done this in 8 years, but I'm going to start with some labels that you put out there about yourself, and then you tell me what importance they have to your life. You ready?
Sure.
Okay. Let's start with photographer. I don't have a lot of photographers on the show. What is Darren's lens through looking at this world through the camera?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens with that. Photography started out as a hobby for me while I was in college. My father was a photographer, and I didn't get to see him do work, but I saw his work around our house. And so it was always a curiosity and a fashion and an interest for me. And then I took a class in school that required me to make my own pictures, and that started something that very quickly became a profession. I remember my first wedding, I had just kind of been shooting photos for people around campus and at church. And someone called me on a Saturday morning and said, I need you to come and photograph my daughter's wedding right now. And so I hurried and gathered my things, and I was like, oh, I guess what I do is a little bit more important than I thought. And it's been a fun adventure since then.
I love it. I love it. All right, label number one done. Label number two, talk to me about that word activist. What does that word mean to you?
So that is a catch-all word that can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. Sometimes it can be a bad word to people. But for me, it is a simple way to describe what I do around motivating people to take action. And that is around issues that are dear to my heart. I was first trained in community activism in a church, and I didn't realize how how central that would be to me, that I can use the parts that are natural to me. I'm an extrovert. I'm a people person who tends to know a lot of people and connect with a lot of people, and to use that as a natural way to get people informed and engaged on topics that are dear to my heart, like LGBTQ inclusion and anti-racism. It's a perfect matchup for me.
Nice. All right, two down, two to go. Intersectional justice seeker. I feel like people are going to be overwhelmed by that. They shouldn't be, but intersectional justice seeker.
Right. So intersectionality is this idea that in all the various identities that we occupy, whether that's our gender, race, economic status, sexual orientation, physical ability, mental ability, all these labels, if you will, or descriptors, as I like to call them, that they interact together. And so sometimes when we're doing justice work, we might only hear about, for example, someone being discriminated against because they're Black. And in a separate conversation, in a separate room, we'll have a conversation about women being discriminated against because they're women.
Right.
And those two groups will work separately about these issues and almost treat them as if they're foreign to one another. Meanwhile, a Black woman will be somewhere having to choose between the parts of her identity and facing doubled or multiplied discrimination because she occupies both those spaces. So intersectionality actually is a lens developed by Kimberly Crenshaw to help us look at the bigger picture and to see how our different identities kind of interact with each other. And hopefully, it's not an answer to anything, but it is a way for us to go, you know, these are the people who are probably most marginalized. And what I've seen from a justice-seeking perspective is if we target the people who are most at the margins for justice, everyone else benefits.
Yeah, I love
it. And instead of just kind of seeking our way into a small part or getting just one group in, you know, for example, gay marriage primarily benefited one particular group. But if we targeted or if we focused our efforts on how can we make the lives of trans women of color who are sex workers, how can we make their lives better? Everyone else's life gets better. And, you know, it's an unpopular kind of thing to say, but we tend to have a super narrow focus. And so intersectionality is a way for me and hopefully those who follow me to open that lens up and to really see how we can benefit everybody.
It really does help everybody. Okay, last one. Who is Darren Calhoun as a worshiper?
As a worshiper. Oh, that is so core to who I am.
Yeah.
And it's something that's been challenged. As a gay man, as somebody who didn't grow up necessarily feeling, I didn't feel talented. There are a lot of things that I do, creative things that people enjoy, but I didn't feel talented. And so when it came to being in church and it came to engaging communities around art or music or dance, I didn't feel like I was supposed to do it. And especially as a gay man, I was often told that I was disqualified from doing it. And so when it came to me and when it came to faith and when it came to how I understand Jesus and what Jesus' impact in the world was, it was like, yeah, I'm created for worship. I'm created in a way that it fills my heart up to pour out love to God and to engage other people in loving each other. Like those things are just kind of core, and they've gotten me through the hardest times of my life. Like I said, I've been pushed aside and cast aside in so many ways, but it was my relationship with God that encouraged me and held me up and really gave me power and a sense of purpose to persevere through it all. And so it's just a natural thing that comes from me and that I really, really, really enjoy.
Yeah. Look, I would like to believe at this point, Darren, that everybody is on the same page, that being a follower of Christ, being a worshiper, you know, is not mutually exclusive to being LGBTQ. I would like to believe we're all just going to wake up and that epiphany will be there. But we also know that's not exactly where we are right now. What is it going to take for us to get there?
Well, I think that it's, you know, people often talk about both sides. Well, both sides need to come together.
Yeah.
I think we have to have a more honest conversation about what the dynamics are, and it's a multifaceted or multi-sided situation. In one regard, the church has definitely earned its bad reputation
right. When
it comes to how it has treated LGBTQ plus people. The church has done horrible things historically and consistently, and they are not over. It's not a part of some distant past or some disconnected history. And so in one regard, the church, even affirming churches, need to own and understand that the church just is not a default safe space or a default welcoming space. And how many times you say everyone is welcome?
Right.
You have to be able to name it. You have to own the impacts that people have experienced in their own lifetime, not just the historical idea of it. And then in the other regard, when it comes to LGBTQ people, a lot of us have been hurt. And so sometimes the safety response is to, I hate all religion. I hate all churches. Everybody who's religious is bad. And I exist in spaces that are atheist. I exist in spaces that are agnostic. And I'm not here to be like, well, not all Christians and not all people of faith, because that not all phrase is really problematic, and we see it in a lot of places. Instead, my hope is to live an example and to work to make policy in church really live out this idea of welcome and this idea of hospitality. And I'm hoping that in us as a church and us as Christians doing the real work that it takes to change our reputation in the world, I'm hoping that through that we actually change this conversation. I think it's on the church. I think it's on people of faith for us to fix our reputation, including LGBTQ people. Now, I'm not saying that we who are oppressed need to somehow own the actions of our oppressors, but I am saying that in this reconciliation work, there's a role that we can play.
There it is. There it is. Again, listeners, we are here with Darren Calhoun, photographer, worship leader, community activist, so much more. Speaking of labels, in some of your brilliant writing, and I've read quite a bit of what you've put out there, this is one of my favorite sections of what you've written. You wrote this, quote, "Some of my choice in using labels to describe parts of who I am is an act of resistance. My experience is unique and part of my everyday life. I won't have my existence erased for the sake of blending into a society that isn't actively trying to erase your existence." Talk to me about resistance. You know, how do we go about diagnosing resistance? And you know, look, I can't just ask you a question like, and how do we get rid of it? Because that feels a little bit overwhelming right now. But what's one step we can take towards overcoming resistance once we diagnose it?
Yeah. So as I and you found a really good quote. I'm glad you're reading. I appreciate that.
I'm trying to do my students proud. I would be a crap professor if I'm just like, his name is Darren Calhoun. What do you got, Darren?
Well, that happens. So I appreciate the due diligence. So when I think about resistance and when I think about our need to have resistance, that's kind of the buzzword right now. And I'm loving that so many people are finding their voice in speaking out against what's happening with this presidential administration. That people are finding where that they can make a difference or where they can attempt to affect change. And so for me, that's what resistance is about. It's this idea that things that are the status quo are probably going to continue to hurt people and continue to be a problem until we do something about it. And so resistance is this idea that we are just engaging in the process to make things better, stronger, different than what they are. Because if we just let things go the way that they have gone, then they're not going to get better for anybody, unless you're an oppressor.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's and I don't know if it completely answers like a 1-2 step, but I think if we all own that things won't get better on their own, and we all do work to find out how we can be a part of making things better, then I think that's the core of resistance. And I think that is the action step. Find something that's local to you. I personally love to go out to a protest. And again, that extroversion in me is like, oh, people, yes, let's go. But for some people, that's a very scary thing. For some people, that may be something that's just logistically not possible. And so it's, you know, find your voice. Maybe you're a great writer. Maybe you are someone who has vote on a board or a council in your community. Maybe you can get a anti-racism training or an inclusion training happening in your job or something. There's some place that you can make the world better for people who are at the margins. Find it.
Yeah.
And that's really the step.
And I certainly don't want to go too negative here, but you made kind of an off-the-cuff comment about, you know, except for the oppressors who benefit. We do have to actually pause here and acknowledge mm-hmm. that there are people actively, not just passively or tangentially, but actively benefiting from marginalization.
Right. And I think there's a really important thing for us to think about. Sometimes when we think about oppression or we think about people who benefit from oppression, because maybe you're not directly writing policy. Maybe you're not the one who is actively discriminating and hiring practices at your job. But you benefit in ways that you probably don't think about. And so sometimes when we talk about oppression, we think about some characteristic bad guy who's walking around with a cape and a dark mask or something. And the reality is that we all probably, at least in America, have some benefit from the oppression that is this country.
Yeah.
And so, one, we have to kind of have to find where do we benefit? You know, that's what intersectionality reminds us of, is that there's some kind of benefits that we have. Where do we benefit? And once we find that and own it, how do we leverage it? Because if you are benefiting from something, for example, if you are in a tax bracket that is right now about to get more tax cuts, quote unquote, to help the poor, then you can find how can I spend my money? How can I affect my local leadership who's listening more to me? Traditionally, politicians, Democrat and Republican, have listened to the wealthy far more often than they listen to anything or anyone else. And so it's like, okay, I benefit from this. How am I going to leverage it? It's not becoming the savior. It's not becoming the one who's going to tell everybody what they need and how to think and how to act. But it's how can I use what I have and what benefit I have to the benefit of those who are normally oppressed or marginalized or cast out.
There it is. There it is. What's coming up for you, Darren, that you're excited about?
Lots of things. Sometimes I just see myself as this regular guy, and I look at my calendar, and I'm like, well, I guess I'm not so regular right now. So I've been doing a lot of traveling, and one of the things that's happening just next week, actually, I'll be with a group of students, and we're going to go down to the National Underground Railroad Museum in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Of course.
And this is just kind of an immersion trip where my friend Rich Havert, who leads this campus ministry at the University of Illinois at Chicago, he wanted to create an experience for students. And I've been going on a similar trip with students from North Park University where they do a multi-day trip. We're just kind of doing a drive down there and come back trip. But the purpose of this is to have this immersive experience where we are talking all the way down on the way there about our experiences with race, the first time that we realized we had a race, the first time that we noticed something was wrong on our campus, those kind of conversations. Then we get there and we have a shared experience where we're learning usually a whole lot more than we normally get in history books or even in some of our online presentations. And then as we come back, we're thinking about how do we now take action together? What's maybe something that's happening in our community that we can begin to engage with? And all that for the hope that we produce more people who are creating change, more people who are affecting change. So it's stuff like that that's kind of on my radar for the rest of this year, where it's just like, yes, another opportunity to share stories, another opportunity for us to have an experience together. This is going to be a good year.
There it is. There it is. Listeners, this is what I need you to do right this very second. Stroll on over to DarrenCalhoun.com. That's Darren with two R's, Calhoun, C-A-L-H-O-U-N.com. You can learn more about Darren. You can learn more about his photography. He is fine with you hiring him for some sort of photography gig. You can learn more about intersectionality. Possibly he will talk to you about intersectionality as he is shooting your wedding. We can combine these things. That's totally fine. Darren, I got to tell you, I've been reading all your writing. You came across my attention because you're doing such great work at so many different intersections, which that's where it's all happening. That's where it has to happen in order for us to make change, exactly as you said. And so really inspiring stuff. And please keep doing what you're doing, sir.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. And thank you for having me on your show. I write often with the hashtag Your Story Matters. And so I love the opportunity to share my story and hope people continue sharing their stories.
When all the world is a hopeless jumble and the raindrops tumble all around, heaven opens a magic lane. When all the clouds darken up the skyway, there's a rainbow, a highway to be found, leading from your windowpane to a place behind the sun, just a step beyond the rain. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere skies are blue and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, but let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. I am certainly going nowhere near Milo Yiannopoulos. Hopefully his time is done. But I will say this. Author Roxanne, who criticized Simon & Schuster when Milo got his book deal, she had a wonderful reflection on the news that Simon & Schuster has now dropped him for his horribleness and the comments that he has made. And she wrote this, and I want to read it because I think this is a piece of the story that's really important. Let's just hopefully forget about Milo Yiannopoulos and Dave Holmes, who I absolutely enjoy. He's got a great book called Party of One. He used to be an MTV VJ. He's an unbelievably talented writer. He's got a great piece about Milo. I can't say it better, so I'm not going near that, but it's all about how he is looking forward to forgetting Milo. But regarding the Simon & Schuster piece, this is what Roxanne Gay wrote. Quote, "In canceling Milo's book contract, Simon & Schuster made a business decision the same way they made a business decision when they decided to publish that man in the first place. When his comments about pedophilia and pederasty came to life, Simon & Schuster realized it would cost them more money to do business with Milo than he could earn for them. They did not finally, quote, do the right thing, and now we know where their threshold, pun intended, lies. They were fine with his racist and xenophobic and sexist ideologies. They were fine with his transphobia, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. They were fine with how he encourages his followers to harass women and people of color and transgender people online. Let me assure you, as someone who endured a bit of that harassment, it is breathtaking in its scope, intensity, and cruelty. But hey, we must protect the freedom of speech." So those were just some of Roxanne Gay's comments. You can follow her on Tumblr. That's a really important piece of the story. So Simon and Schuster putting out there that they're doing the right thing now, or people saying, well, yes, that's what they should have done. No, it's not the right thing that they have now done. So I'm moving on from that because there actually is other news out there. We are awaiting whatever news is coming from the White House, which we don't have at the time of this recording, about the protections that were issued for trans students, the guidelines that the President Obama White House put out there and the Department of Education put out there to protect trans students. Word is that those protections are going to be rescinded, though we don't know exactly what that verbiage is going to look like. So we will see. That's coming down the pike. In the great state of Nevada, a state representative from Nevada wants to amend its constitution to protect same-sex marriage. Nelson Araujo, the Assistant Assembly Majority Leader, has proposed the state amend its governing document in order to protect from being challenged in court if the 2015 Supreme Court decision is overturned. Currently, Nevada defines marriages between one man and one woman, but has allowed same-sex marriages since the Supreme Court's decision 2 years ago. Announcing Joint Resolution 2 in January, Mr. Araujo said the Silver State should, quote, issue marriage licenses to couples regardless of gender. You know, I saw this headline on Twitter, and I think I actually had some snarky reply. This is where I take responsibility. I had some snarky reply like, okay, do you really need to update your constitution to reflect the law? Is this a big story? And now that I am fully appreciating this is a preventative measure, this is something that these representatives there in the great state of Nevada are trying to do, anticipating that the Supreme Court might overturn. This is actually a really important thing, and I apologize for scoffing at that. And right after I finish recording this, I'm going to go delete my own tweet, because that was not the right thing to do. See? We take responsibility. In Missouri, legislators in Missouri are considering introducing the state's own bathroom bill. They're getting in on the action, too, there in Missouri. Yep, their own bathroom bill targeting the rights of transgender children in public schools. The bill's sponsor, Senator Ed Emery, said the goal of the legislation would be to protect students' privacy, but it has been strongly contested by parents of transgender children who say that the bill will put their kids at risk of bullying. Similar to measures already passed in North Carolina and proposed in other states, including Texas, the Missouri bill would mean children in public schools could only use locker rooms and bathrooms corresponding to their gender at birth. Senator Emery said this, quote, "We get in those situations and you are inviting abuse." There you go. The Associated Press reports that a 13-year-old trans girl, Samantha DiMicelli, broke down in tears telling legislators about being bullied. She said this, quote, "I'm not in the bathroom to do anything bad, to vandalize or to peek in the stalls. I'm there to pee and wash my hands." That's it. That's it, folks. The bill would allow alternative restroom access to trans kids if they are given parental permission in writing. And again, the similar bill there in North Carolina has cost that state billions of dollars. In Texas, where they are considering the same thing, investors worth a combined $11 trillion have warned Texas not to pass this anti-LGBT legislation. Last week, the NBA weighed in on a proposed Texas anti-LGBT bathroom bill, suggesting that the state could lose future All-Star games if it is passed. And now there is a coalition of investors worth a combined, again, $11 trillion, saying this will absolutely affect our doing business in your state. It will absolutely affect our doing business in your state. So this is what you need to weigh out. Our colleagues there in Texas who have that kind of power to pass this legislation, you are going to lose a lot. I question what you are going to gain. It's not what you think you're going to gain. Not at all. All right, folks, that's really it for this week's episode. Our huge thanks to Karen Mason. You must pick up her new album, It's About Time. I have been listening to it nonstop. It is incredible. And of course, our thanks to Darren Calhoun, who is doing incredible work on his end. Go support his efforts, read his writing, and share it. And of course, our thanks to you guys for listening. Get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?